There are three different times that we find in Chumash the prohibition of losevashel gedi b'chalev imo. You're not allowed to cook meat and milk together. One is in our parsha, Parshas Re'eh. Twice the Torah mentions it in Sefer Shemos. And the Gemara says in Maseches Chulin Daf Kuf Dalet, in trying to understand why this is mentioned three different times, the Gemara says, number one, this expands and it includes all meat and all milk. It's not just a gedi b'chalev imo. It's not only when you have a young calf with its mother's milk. We assume that it's all milk and all meat. And the Gemara expands this as well and says, because it's written three different times in the Torah, therefore we assume there are three different prohibitions. Issur number one is achila. You're not allowed to eat it. You're not allowed to consume it. Number two, you're not allowed to have any benefit from it. And number three, you're not allowed to violate the prohibition of bishul either. You're not allowed to cook it. So that's the three reasons why we have three different psukim to tell us what seemingly should be the same thing. Chazal decided to extend this as well because they were concerned that maybe you would make a mistake. And they said, although the Torah only instructs us to stay away from cooking meat and actual milk together, Chazal said we have to extend that and say that chicken, for all intents and purposes, is going to be considered like meat as well. And therefore, even though the Torah itself would have no objection at all to cooking chicken with milk, that's not at all what the prohibition was based on the pasuk, Chazal said people interchangeably use chicken and meat, and therefore we have to be concerned. So you're not allowed to cook chicken with meat either. I'm sorry, you're not allowed to eat chicken with milk either. And that is the issur that is mentioned in Chazal. Although we just said that this is mentioned three different times in Chumash, and we derive from here three different prohibitions, achila, hana'a, and bishul. What's interesting is that the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch, when they make a counting, a listing of all the various Taryag mitzvahs, they say that here we only find two prohibitions, two categories of issur. One of them, says the Rambam, is an issur bishul, you're not allowed to cook. Number two, says the Rambam, we have what we refer to as the issur achila. Obviously, what's notably missing is the issur hana, the issur to get benefit and pleasure from the basar b'chalav. So why do you leave it out? So the Rambam tells us because that is subsumed under the category of achila. Part of not being allowed to eat it is you're also not allowed to have any other benefit. The same way you're not allowed to eat, you're also not allowed to do anything else with it either. And therefore, the Rambam says that we only count this as two separate isurim. Other Rishonim say, why shouldn't we just count it as one? Subsumed under the one category of basar b'chalav is three different parts to the isur. You're not allowed to eat, you're not allowed to cook, you're not allowed to have benefit. All those are considered to be the same. So this is a major discussion. It's not really so relevant how many violations you actually violate if you would do something, but this is the basic assumption that one has three different ways of applying the pasuk in Chumash. You're not allowed to eat, you're not allowed to cook, and you're not allowed to get any benefit. So the Rambam writes in the Sefer Morah HaNevuchim, and there in the Morah HaNevuchim, the Rambam very often gives us a reason for a mitzvah, which if you look in the Torah itself, you might not find, but the Rambam says what he feels might be a reason behind some of the instructions that the Torah gives us. So here, the Rambam as well goes out of his way to tell us that although if you look in the Torah itself, we find no reason at all for the prohibition of basar b'chalav, he gives his own reason, and it's very relevant because it explains the psukim and chumash themselves. Says the Rambam, Asher le'isur basar b'chalav. You ask me, what is the reason why God told us we're not allowed to eat basar b'chalav? I would have said, God didn't tell us a reason. So the Rambam agrees that the Torah itself does not give us a reason, but he says, I have a feeling. And he says, it's not really based on much, but I have a feeling as to why the Torah said this is prohibited. He says, it's not so crazy to imagine that in the days of the Ovdei Avodah Zarah, when they used to serve all kinds of different religions, he said it's not crazy to imagine that part of their sacrifices or part of the way they celebrated their holidays was that they would come around and cook meat and milk together. And says the Rambam, it seems that that was probably a practice, although he says I haven't found this in my research in the other religions. He says I would imagine that that's what they used to do. And therefore the Rambam says, that is really where we came up with our prohibition from. God says, I don't want you to be like them. I don't want you to have anything to do with those religions. And therefore, says the Rambam, God told us that we have to stay so far away from Avodah Zarah, we're not even allowed to cook the same way that they used to cook and when they got together to celebrate their religion, to celebrate their Avodah Zarah. And the Rambam then tells us, perhaps this is the understanding of the way the formulation of the pasuk was structured in the first place. Says the Rambam, if you look carefully in the Torah, you find something very unusual. Shalosh pa'amim bashana yera'eh kol zechurcha es panei ha'adon Hashem. The pasuk in Sefer Shmos. Three times a year we have to go up aliyah l'regel to visit the Ribono shel Olam in his Beis HaMikdash. And there, at the very end of that pasuk, we're told, lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo. What's the connection? go up to Be'olah Regel, go visit Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash, and make sure not to cook Basar V'Chalav. What's the connection between the two mitzvahs? Says the Rambam, it's very simple. Because the other religions used to go and visit their God, and what they would do on those occasions was they would cook Basar V'Chalav. Therefore, says the Rambam, our religion says, when you're going up to visit God in His holy temple in the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, make sure not to do like them. Lo Savashu Gidi B'Chalav Imo. Says the Rambam, this is the way they used to do, and therefore this is why we are not allowed to do it. So that's an interesting idea, I think. It gives some meaning to the Pasuk. And the Rambam himself admits he's not totally certain that this is correct. But he says perhaps this is an interpretation as to why the Torah itself instructs us to stay away from Basar B'Chalav. On top of the basic Torah prohibition in our parsha of eating Basar B'Chalav, of cooking Basar B'Chalav, and of deriving benefit from Basar B'Chalav, the Chachamim also told us that we have to extend it further, and we need to create certain harchakos, certain boundaries, because we're concerned maybe something will lead a person to eating Basar B'Chalav. So for example, the Gemara says in Chulin Daf Kuf Gimel, if you have one person who's eating dairy and one person who's eating meat, they are not supposed to be eating together at the same table with one another, because we're concerned maybe I'm going to bend over and I'm going to take a little bit from your plate, you're going to take something to eat from my plate, and we're concerned of Basar B'Chalav, which is a concern on top of a concern. Because the Torah itself in the first place said, you're not allowed to cook Basar B'Chalav together and eat it. Here, even if I lean over to your plate and I take something that's meat or dairy from the other person's plate, I won't be in violation of cooking it and then eating something that's cooked together. All I'm doing is mixing it up in my mouth. And yet, the Chachamim said, that is also an extension of this prohibition. Obviously, it's only Midirabanan, but they told us, this is something we need to be careful about. However, I've gotten this question many times. Some people in an office building have a communal dining room where they all go together to eat. So somebody has asked me that, how can I go to such a dining room if I know that the person next to me is going to be eating non-kosher sandwich, or the person next to me is going to be eating milchik fleishigs? Maybe all the Jewish people sit around together and eat lunch together. I don't know if they do or they don't, but he said, if the Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to sit with somebody who is eating meat or dairy, certainly you're not allowed to sit with somebody who's eating non-kosher food right next to you. So how can we sit in these cafeterias? It's a good question. However, the Shulchan Aruch does say that there are many, many leniencies that would be applicable to this halacha. Number one, if you have any clear demarcation that shows I'm eating mine and you're eating yours. So for example, it says, if you put out a mappa, I put out a placemat underneath mine, you put out a placemat underneath yours, that's a clear demarcation that mine is mine and yours is yours, and we're not going to switch. I would say today, if I go and I bought lunch, and now I have a plastic bag that the lunch came in, and I'm keeping that plastic bag under my sandwich, it's clear that this is mine and yours is yours. Similarly, the Shulchan Aruch says it only applies if you have two people who are makirim ze'ezeh, we happen to be friendly with one another, and it would be reasonable to assume that I would reach over and take something from your plate. But if it just happens to be a co-worker, it's probably considered to be inappropriate to lean over to the other person's plate and take something to eat. That's something that we don't have to be concerned about. And therefore, in such a case, the Chazal were not concerned at all. And more fundamentally, we all know that the Chachamim also instituted that you have to wait 6 hours, 3 hours, 1 hour, all different minhagim between eating meat and eating milk for the same reason. Not because we're concerned you're going to really cook it up in your stomach when they all get eaten up together, but rather we're concerned if you're not going to separate between meat and milk, maybe it's going to lead to something worse, which next time you're going to come to cook the meat and the milk. We know that there's a discussion regarding other areas of halacha as to how to properly define the act of cooking. Let's say, for example, on Shabbos, we're not allowed to be engaged in the act of cooking. How do you define what's considered to be cooking? So we have a discussion, the Gemara Maseches Shabbos Daf Chaf writes that we have an individual by the name of Ben Drusai. Who is Ben Drusai? Ben Drusai, Rashi writes, was a person who was a bandit, he was a fugitive, and he was always stealing from other people, and because of that, he was always on the run, the police were always after him, and he didn't have time to cook his meals the way that normal people would eat meals. So Rashi writes, he only used to cook his meals shlish bishulo. He would just cook it a third of the normal way that we generally would cook food, and then he would take it off the fire, he would go run into hiding somewhere, and that's the way he would eat. The Rambam says, no, he would wait around till it was cooked halfway. And then he would stop, and he would take the food, and he would eat it. His name was Ben Drusai. I'm not sure why this bandit, why this robber and this fugitive is the one who goes down in halacha as Michael Ben Drusai. What did he do in life that he deserves this honor? I don't know. But either way, we assume that on Shabbos, in order to violate the malacha of Bishul, you have to cook something at least until it's Michael Ben Drusai. If it's at least cooked to the point where this robber would have eaten it, which means it's cooked a third of the process or a half of the process, then you would say that's already considered to be cooked. What about when we talk about bishul with regard to basar v'chalav? When would you consider something to be cooked that I'm in violation of this prohibition of lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo? Is it the same rules as Hilchos Shabbos or perhaps not? So this is a discussion and a machlokas between Abaye and Rava, between Levi and Rav, both in Gemara Pesachim and in Gemara Chulin, where the Gemara discusses whether Recha Milsa or Recha Lav Milsa. What does Recha mean? Recha means when you have an aroma, when you have a fume that comes out of a food that I'm cooking. So for example, you have something which, let's say you cook bread in the oven. There's nothing tangible that you can feel that comes out of the bread. There's just an aroma in the oven from the bread that you're cooking, from the bread that you're baking, I should say. So there's a discussion, would we assume that an aroma alone is considered to be significant and that can give over a taste into something else that's being cooked in that oven? Or perhaps you say, that's totally insignificant, that's so negligible, it's so minor, there's nothing really that comes from that aroma, and therefore there'd be no problem at all to cook two items together where there's just an aroma that goes from one to the other. That's a discussion that the Gemara has, and the psak of most of the Rishonim, the Rambam and the Rush and the Rif, they all say that Recha Lav Milsa, if you just have a fume, if you just have an aroma coming out of a food item, that's not enough to make that taste go into something else because there's really nothing to it, there's nothing tangible that comes out. However, the Rush writes in a tshuva that he penned to his son, this is only when you're talking about Recha, that's only when you have an aroma. What about when you have actual Zeya, which means when you have actual steam that emerges or that is withdrawn from the item? There, says the Rama, says the Rush, we would assume if, let's say, you're cooking some soup and there's steam that comes out of the soup, we would assume the steam has the same, what do you call that? The same status, thank you, as whatever the soup is. So if the soup is a chalent, let's say, and you have, obviously, there's meat in the chalent, so then we would say all the steam that comes up from it is considered to be meat as well. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch writes, we have to be concerned if, let's say, you have one pot that's cooking milchigs, and right on top of it you take an item that is fleishigs, and it has the steam that's going to come directly into it, you have to be concerned that now the steam has transferred the milchig flavor into the meat, and now that meat has become treif, because now it has milk and meat in it together, and that would be a problem. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, let's say, for example, you have dried salamis that you hang from the ceiling. So do I have to be careful where I hang them? Because if they're anywhere near the oven, maybe there's going to be steam that's going to come up from my lasagna or something like that, and that's going to cause an issue, says the Shulchan Aruch. Well, it depends. If it's hanging from the ceiling, and by the time the steam gets all the way up to the ceiling, it's going to be cooled off already, it's going to be so diffused, so then obviously you don't have to worry. But if it's still going to be in a place where if you would put your hand there, it would still be hot, the steam that's emerging from the pot that you're cooking, that would be an issue. Why do I mention all of this? I mention all of it because I often go to Citibank, to the wonderful Lunch and Learns that we have, and I've thought about this many times. So in Citibank, you do it properly, but I've gone to Lunch and Learns in other offices where there's an issue that I think does not get enough attention because people, I think, are simply not aware of the issue at hand. So we have, nowadays, something that we refer to as a chafing dish. A chafing dish is, I'm sure we all have seen this, it's a metal pan where we have sternos underneath, and you put a pan with water in the first metal pan, in the first aluminum, and you heat up the water, and then the water is going to be able to heat up the food that you put in a pan on top. Obviously, the food is not directly on the water. The water heats up, that heat, that steam rises, goes up to the pan that has the food in it, and that's the way that we retain the heat when we sometimes are going to serve it on a table or at a lunch, whatever we're going to do. The problem of doing so is as follows. The Shulchan Aruch writes that one venue of transferring taste from one to another is, if I have two pots next to each other, I often get this question. Somebody realizes I took a pot off the fire, and now there's a pot right next to it, one's milchigs, one's fleishigs. We don't assume that any transfer of taste is going to go from one to the other. Just because you have one pan next to another that's, both of them are hot, we don't assume anything goes, unless, says the Shulchan Aruch, you have the medium of liquid in between. Ein kli bolea mi kli below rote. One vessel cannot, one utensil cannot give over taste to another unless there's some medium of moisture that goes in between them that's going to transfer the taste from one to the other. So here I have this big pan of hot water. I heat up the hot water, and on top of it I have, let's say, fleishig lunch. I have whatever it might be. So the assumption in Shulchan Aruch is clearly, it explains, it basically describes this case the water that's heated up is going to have steam that's going to emerge from the water. That steam is going to go up to the pan that's right on top of it. Basically, it's going to go into the pan. The pan is then going to send it right back down. And now you have the steam becomes fleishigs. That fleishig steam goes back into the water pan underneath and now makes the pan fleishigs as well. Everything's fine. What happens next time? We kept that pan that had the water in it. And the next time around, we serve lasagna for lunch. And we use the same pan because why wouldn't you? I didn't have any food that touched that. There was no food that went into it. And people don't realize that it's a major problem. Because the next time around, you're going to heat up water in this fleishig pan that became fleishig because of the last time that I used it to heat up my fleishig lunch. Now I have a fleishig pan that's heating up water. The steam is going to go up. That steam is now going to be fleishigs, but now it's going into my lasagna. It's going to make the lasagna problematic, and it's going to go back into the bottom pan and make that milchigs fleishigs. It's going to be all confused. There are many business offices, I was told. Sometimes they have luncheons that are not kosher at all, but sometimes they have luncheons that are catering to kosher members of the staff. So how do you use the same sterno for the non-kosher items as for the kosher days when you have lunch that is served? This is a major issue that touches on exactly what the Shulchan Aruch describes. When you have two utensils, when you have two items, and you have a medium of steam or water that goes from one to the other, that is a way of transferring taste from one to the other, and therefore in our very general circumstances that we've seen ourselves in many, many times, one has to be very careful that you use a pan of water that was never used for anything that is the opposite, either milchigs or fleishigs, or kosher or non-kosher. You have to be very careful that you watch to be careful and show that everything that you're using is of the same status as whatever it is that you're trying to heat up. Rav Hanani ben Akash Omer.